Good evening. Welcome to Probabilities. My name is Richard Walensky. I'm the editor of the KPFA Folio. And with me, Richard A. Lupoff, whose most recent novel is The Comic Book Killer. And our guest this evening is Sue Grafton, author of the Kinsey Millhone Mysteries, the most recent of which is F is for Fugitive, but other ones include A is for Alibi, B is for Burglar, C is for Corpse, and so on and so forth. You grew up in Louisville, Kentucky.
I did.
And you're the daughter of a mystery writer.
Mm-hmm.
Did you read a lot of mysteries when you were growing up?
Yeah, my parents were very passionate about books, and in those days you could get a paperback novel for a quarter, so my father would walk us up to the drugstore after dinner and buy stacks of paperbacks. In our house we had one of those revolving drugstore racks, and my mother would read these books and she would mark them dirty or dull or good, and my sister and I were allowed to read anything we wanted because their theory was that after we had read enough dull and dirty books, we would prefer the good ones, which is in fact what happened. But while the other little girls in my neighborhood were reading Nancy Drew, I was reading Mickey Spillane.
What did you think of Mickey Spillane?
I liked it a lot. I can still remember Eye of the Jury. I was really bug-eyed when I read that one.
Did you start writing at all or think about writing mysteries at the time?
No, I started writing what they call mainstream fiction. And I had a couple of books published when I was in my 20s. But it really wasn't right for me. I knew my days were numbered. The second of the books, the screen rights were bought, and I ended up co-authoring the screenplay.
That was Lolly Madonna,
yes.
XXX.
Yes, thank you. Uh-huh. We still see that on the late show sometimes. But honestly, sometimes I get a check for as much as $73 from that, even after all these years.
You didn't like it, though.
No, I didn't. But, you know, I look back on it. That book had 14 characters, and I would never, in my right mind, do a film script with 14 fully fleshed-out characters. But it was a learning experience, and it got me launched as a writer in terms of supporting myself.
How did it come about that you wound up writing the screenplay? Because I assume that's what brought you to Hollywood.
Yes. A British film producer bought the rights and came over to this country and asked me to help him do it since the book was largely about Appalachia. And he felt I was perhaps better qualified to write about it than he, although that's not necessarily true. But I did learn screenplay for him, and I've been earning a living doing movies for television since then.
Some of the ones you've done include A Caribbean Mystery, which was, I believe, Helen Hayes as Miss Marple.
That's right, that's right.
And Sparkling Cyanide,
yes,
with
Anthony Andrews.
Anthony Andrews,
Deborah,
yeah.
Deborah Raffin.
Raffin, yeah.
Yes, my husband Steve Humphrey and I do those together. And, in fact, Caribbean Mystery was filmed about half a mile from our house in Santa Barbara, but you would never know from looking at it.
How did you rework Agatha Christie there to do that?
Yeah, well, that was a bit of a trick because the American producers wanted to update that and make it American instead of British. So a purist, an Agatha Christie purist, would be properly horrified. But our finding was that when you dismantle some of those books, the A-plus books do not get sold to television. So what we end up with in television are the lesser works. And some of those, when you dismantle them in order to construct a screenplay, you discover there are egregious errors or, you know, gaps in the logic, and it's very problematic to make them come together. Also, Agatha Christie is not famous for her characterization, and that gets to be a bit of a problem, too.
Well, that's an interesting point, and we're going to want to talk about your own books, but since we're on screenplays, let's spend a few minutes there. There's a certain process that takes place that you speak of as deconstruction.
Yes.
Followed by, just if you talk about that whole process a little
bit. Okay.
Well,
I will if I'm able. We'll just work our way around that one. One of the things I learned in Hollywood is structure, and I think that's what you look at when you take a mystery and disassemble it and put it back together again. I think the requirements of film are very different than those of the printed word. And what looks one way on paper will play very differently, which is why there's often such a discrepancy between a written book and the filmed version of it. But I think it's been helpful for me to learn to write dramatically. It makes you think in scenes. It makes you think in terms of how a story rises you know, to a payoff at the end. And I think in that respect, the mystery and the screenplay have some things in common in that both need to be very carefully structured.
You also wrote, it says, the story credit for Svengali. Was that the Peter O'Toole thing?
That, let me think, who finally played in that, because that was a script I did years ago, and in the end, they took it away from me and another writer did it. It may well have been.
Did you go back to the early movies, or how did you create it?
I went back to the original and looked at that, and again, it was a story that was updated and made contemporary. It was fun to do, but it was one of those Hollywood stories where, mercifully, we blank on that after all these years.
You didn't go back and read the George du Maurier novel, or
yes,
did you?
Yes, yes.
What
oh,
did you
yeah.
think of it?
It was very antique. And in fact, it was fun to modernize that or make mm-hmm. it more contemporary.
You were in Hollywood for quite a few years, and you say you still make a
yes.
Living in there. What's your favorite Hollywood horror story that you've
Uh-oh.
Witnessed? Everybody has them.
Well, I have been fortunate in that I've worked with some very nice people and some very smart people. I did once work for a man who shall be nameless, lest his lawyers are listening. But I was always very dutiful, and yet I ended up in a... They brought me out to do a ripoff of some quite famous movie, which I was dutifully typing away at. And every day this man would call me into his office and tell me how the story should go. And at night they rented me this terrible little room in the studio, and I would sit and type and turn the pages in the next day. And every morning he would say to me, "Major flaws, major flaws," and we would start all over again. Finally, I had a 4 o'clock plane, and I met with these two men at probably 1 or 1:30, and got major flaws again. And I just put my briefcase together and marched out of the room. And he has been furious with me to this day, calling me some quite nasty names. But it was the only time I have ever walked away from a job, and I felt quite righteous about it.
To get back to the beginning of your career, you mentioned as a child in Louisville reading Mickey Spillane and all of
yes.
these other good, bad, or dirty books.
Yes.
Good, boring, or dirty
yes.
were the three classifications. If you talk, for one thing, a little bit more about that reading, and secondly, there's a long biographical gap between a little girl reading Mickey Spillane and a young woman writing Lolly Madonna.
Yeah. Well, I, like many girls in my era, which seems quite a long time ago, when I began to think about writing, the books that were being written were all about two men on the road, and I wasn't allowed to hitchhike, so I thought I had not a chance of a career in the field of writing. But I imagined at that time I would teach or do something equally benign. I was always passionate about writing, but it just never occurred to me that one could make a living at it.
Mm-hmm.
So for many years, I worked in the medical field as a cashier and a hospital admissions clerk, and I worked in doctor's offices and would do my writing at night because I was at the same time married and raising children.
Mm-hmm.
So most of my writing took place after the kids were in bed and the cat had been put out on the back step.
And this is where your early novels came from, though.
Yes, although the first was about the Depression, which I wrote when I was in my early 20s, knowing virtually nothing about the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
But I was so innocent in those days, it just never occurred to me that one had to do research. And now I'm very meticulous about research. I really spend quite a lot of time trying to be informed about what I'm doing. But the two books were published when I was in my 20s. Then I made the detour into screenplay form.
Yes.
And now I suspect I'll be doing books almost exclusively.
Do you feel that you're part of the famous or infamous Southern literary tradition?
I wish I could say I was. I doubt it. I doubt they would consider me a bona fide member. In the late 70s, after I'd been working in Hollywood for 7 or 8 years, I began to feel that the writing by committee was very destructive,
mm-hmm.
and it seemed to me if I wanted to salvage and redeem whatever writing skills I had left, I had best get back to solo writing. And what they had been telling me at that time was that I was good at character, but I couldn't do plot.
Mm-hmm.
So it seemed to me that if I were going to teach myself how to plot, the one place I had best learn it would be in the mystery novels. So that's why I chose that, and also because my father had done it. So that's how I segued from the film work into the novel again?
A is for Alibi introduces, I guess we're appropriately coming up on that now, introduces
yes.
a character named Kinsey Milhone, who you've said is very similar to yourself.
Yes.
How'd you come up with the name Kinsey and Milhone?
Kinsey, I was reading my Hollywood Reporter, and they always have a section where they announce birth. So there was a couple in Hollywood who apparently named their daughter Kinsey, and it was one of those things when I saw it, I thought, aha, that's for me. So I snagged it. Later, I added the Milhone because I like the way the sounds played. I've been accused of being a yuppie over that one, but I promise it was not for those reasons. But I kept the name for a period of time just sitting on my desk before I understood where it was going to fit into my life.
Why did you call Santa Barbara Santa Teresa?
In part because Ross McDonald had called it Santa Teresa and I was paying homage to him. In part because I find it liberating to assign other names to towns. I'm not writing about the real police in Santa Barbara. I am not writing about city government. If I want to, because I call it Santa Teresa, I can change the weather. I'm very powerful. I can move buildings. If I need a chase sequence and the geography is not laid out properly, I can alter it. It keeps me from being self-conscious. It's really very freeing. Sometimes I drive down to Kinsey's neighborhood and I can't find her building. It's very distressing, you know, because I feel I've invented it quite nicely.
For those of us who know Santa Barbara a bit, what is her actual neighborhood?
Her office is at 903 State Street, which is up above the Crown Jewelry Store. There's a mm-hmm. coffee shop called Little Audrey's.
Oh, I know that shop.
Uh-huh. Oh, it's upstairs.
She's in that building near
yes.
Joseph the Provider.
He's gone now. It's his place.
Oh, how wonderful.
Yeah.
All right. So she's in an ex-bookstore.
That's right.
That's great.
She lives on Mason Street near a sort of patch of land that is actually Indian territory, as I understand it, near the Ambassador by the Sea Motel, mm-hmm. which fronts onto Cabrillo. See, I change these names, I guess, so I can't remember what reality is. But there isn't actually a building down there. I find it very distressing. Maybe they'll build me one of these days.
She's 32 years old in A is for Alibi, and we
yes.
were talking about this just before we went on the air. And you have these books appear a few months after, so now it's still early 1983.
Yes.
You know, we're already well into 1989. Do you plan on having it become a period piece
yes.
now? Or?
No, and I'm going to speed the process up to some extent, but it seems to me the advantage of a fictional character is they don't have to age at the same rate we do, nor does she ever have to gain weight mm-hmm. or do anything unpleasant, but I don't intend to write period pieces. G is for Gumshoe takes place in May of 83, and I may jump forward 6 or 8 months when the next book comes along.
Have you figured out what H, I, J, and K and all those
Some
will be?
Some I know. I had always thought H would be for homicide, but now at signings people keep saying to me, well, I hope you're not going to do anything so trite as to make it H's for homicide. So I quickly pretend I'm going to be much more imaginative than that. But I'm looking for H titles if you want to send me a postcard.
we'll be happy to.
I want to head back to A is for Alibi.
All right.
A couple of points. First off, how did that particular book come about? I read that it involved an idea you had and how you felt about an ex-husband.
Yes.
And also the title, where did the A, B, C, D, E come from?
Well, part of the title itself, that sequence came because my father had written a couple of books based on a nursery rhyme. His two novels in his very short-lived series were The Rat Began to Gnaw the Rope and The Rope Began to Hang the Butcher. And I, at the time I was considering the genesis of A is for Alibi, I had been reading the Edward Gorey category, those mm-hmm. cartoons, and it was one of those things where the two thoughts just came together. I wish I could report a blinding flash of light, because I look back on it and it seems to me a very brilliant marketing strategy, but at the time it just seemed like a fun idea. I understand since then that Lawrence Treat has done some short stories, V as in victim, mm-hmm. H as in homicide. But as far as I know, he was not writing about a series character, and the alphabetizing was not sequential. But I had been going through a bitter divorce at that period of time, and in those days I didn't know how to fight. I am much better equipped now. But I used to spend a lot of time lying in bed thinking of ways to kill him. And since I am, in fact, such a law-abiding little bun, I realized that I would never get away with it. So it seemed to me the next best thing was to put it in a book and get paid for it, you see. And truly, I've launched a whole new career. I must say, I made this statement on a radio station in Milwaukee, and the lines started lighting up, and I was taken so to task for admitting I had homicidal urges. So I say that if your phone lines start blinking, I'm leaving this room.
Well, were the callers calling to say, me too, or were they calling
to express rage?
Oh, no.
They were calling to say, how dare you?
How dare you even think this?
That's right, yeah. And I thought, listen, I didn't do it. I just thought about it. But that was not good enough. I was really, I got flop sweat over that interview, I'm telling
really?
You. Really? Oh, it was just appalling.
Just out of curiosity, or maybe a little more malice than curiosity, do you recall, was there a predominant gender mix among those callers?
Predominantly male. And as it turned out, the interviewer ended up saying to the people on the radio, well, it's not easy to get guests for this show, you know. I thought I would die. Oh, it was the worst interview I've ever had.
If that had been a male mystery author who had told the identical story about how I was so mad at my wife going through a divorce that I wanted to kill her, but of course I couldn't, so I wrote the novel instead. Do you think the response would have been the same?
I'm not sure. I think I sound like a pushover, and I have a slight accent that some people may hear, though I swear it's not actually in my voice. And I suspect I just sounded like a fair target, but there were preachers and then they all start arguing with each other about whether there was violence in the Bible and things of that ilk.
This was in Milwaukee, you said?
Yeah, well, yes. So I don't think I'm going back to that station. So I'm just warning you guys, you better be really nice to me.
After A is for alibi came B is for burglar. Now, there was a break, which there often is, between a first and a second novel. What you did, though, in the novel was you took Kinsey out of Santa Teresa and put her in Florida.
Yes.
Did you take trips to Florida and work the whole thing out?
I had been in Florida briefly some years before, and I couldn't at that point afford to go back down there to do the research, so I just depended on sense memory for that. But the gap between A and B was because when I wrote A, I had nothing to lose. I figured the worst that would happen is I could fail at this. And suddenly, I got a review in Newsweek about Fainted. And at that point, I got kind of self-conscious. Mm-hmm. And it just froze me up. So, as I say, it took me a couple of years to coax my soul back into my body so that I could start writing again.
And B is for Burglar won a whole bunch of awards, the Seamus Award, the Anthony Award.
Yes. Well, I think I had heard later that A is for Alibi got a bit of attention, but I was not nominated for anything, and so they all felt so guilty when B is for Burglar came along. They gave me some presents for that one.
These awards, though, that Rich mentioned, the Seamus, the Anthony, and so forth, these come from various writers' associations within the mystery field.
Yes.
The classic organization in that field, I believe it's almost 50 years old now, is Mystery Writers of America. In recent years, there's been a lot of turmoil and dissension there, to the point even of schismatic groups forming, private eye writers of America, the American Crime Writers League, and they're all hurling brickbats at one another. How do you perceive this?
Well, I suspect Private Eye Writers was formed really because hard-boiled private eye writing seems to be a little bit apart from mainstream, classical, traditional cozies, that sort of writing. And it happens I am the new president of PWA.
Oh, all right.
I don't see PWA as necessarily involved in any political brickbatting back and forth. And I have not understood. I have been invited to join the Crime Writers League and some of the others, and I just can't see why they exist. I just don't understand what their function is. They will put together these newsletters, so your mail is just piled high with these peculiar newsletters. So I have declined to join any of the other organizations because I've got enough mail coming into my house. But I really try to keep myself quite separated from the politics of writing. I don't write for that reason. In fact, I write, my affection for mystery writers is because I think they're such terrific people. So I'm more inclined to lean toward things that bring us together. Personally, I don't think mystery writing is gender related in any way.
But a lot of people do, and in fact there's a lot of uproar over that. I understand there was a recent survey over the number of books reviewed in a span of 6 months in the New York Times based on the gender of the author versus the number of books published in the same period based on the gender of the author. And was there a discrepancy? And the people who did the survey determined that there was.
Yeah, I don't know what those surveys have shown since then. And I don't know. See, if a woman gets reviewed and gets trashed, is that better than being ignored? These are pithy questions that trouble writers late at night.
What do you think?
Well, they say getting your name in print is worth something, no matter what they say about you. But I know what it's like to get bad reviews, and I just soon eat my gun.
Well, how have the critics treated you?
They have been kindly, which is not to say I don't take my licks like everybody else. Mm-hmm. Once in a while, you so offend somebody's sensibilities that they come after you. And those reviews, you can tell you have just triggered somebody's stuff, you know, and they decide to take you to task. There was a woman reviewer, as a matter of fact, in some, probably Texas, who referred to B is for boring. And I'm waiting for her. In my travels, I am certain our paths will cross. It is best not to be tacky to a mystery writer's because we have ways of getting even.
Moving on to F is for Fugitive, we're talking with Sue Grafton, and this is your most recent novel. Floral Beach, is that a real place?
It is, in fact, Avila Beach. But again, I call it Floral Beach because it is an F word, and you'll see that usually for each title, I'll come up with names and place names that are related to the letter of the alphabet I'm dealing with. But I am not writing about the actual citizens of Floral Beach, I promise, nor the actual principal of San Luis Obispo High School, which I call Central Coast High School. Mm-hmm. But it's a wonderful town. The minute you may have seen Avila Beach. It just looks like something out of a movie, so I couldn't resist writing about it.
You have a character named Ori who's sick with diabetes. Yes. Does that come from your days as dealing with medical stuff?
Oh, some of it. Well, it comes from my horror of needles. I mean, that was fun to deal with. But I did a lot of research into that aspect of the book just because it seemed like an interesting thing to play around with. But the critics are saying that these characters are so sleazy. See, and I think they're darling. I am crazy about these people. I mean, villains are always more interesting than the good guys, for starters. So I like Ori. I mean, I know she whines.
What about hypocritical preachers? It seems to me that you've really got a pop gun out for hypocritical
I know. I'm
going to
lay off. I'm going to lay off.
Oh, please don't. I love it, but I would just like you to talk about it
a
little.
I don't know. When you grow up in Kentucky, you see a lot of fundamentalist religion, and those are the only ones I pick on, but I got to watch my mouth because I get carried away sometimes. But they are fun. I don't feel qualified to lay into anybody else. I don't know enough about Catholicism, for instance, to make fun of the Catholics, so I just have to stick to the Baptists.
You have a character named Anne, had as a child having something called celiac disease, which I had as a child. And I was a fat little baby, and then I became very skinny and stayed skinny my whole life.
Oh.
It was just interesting reading about a character who went through something I went through, and I have vague memories of horrible things that happened when I was like 5 and 6 years old.
Well, because I'm sure to some extent they imagine in this day and age that it's psychosomatic or you're having stress or your parents are misbehaving in some way and making you crazy, and therefore you're acting out by having stomach aches, but it interests me that sometimes medical problems are genuinely medical problems and have real cures.
You also go into the law in terms of what happens to a criminal who escapes who may in fact be innocent. Did you check on that? I mean, could he then be charged for more crimes?
What happened, I had clipped a lot of articles about men who had walked away from prison sentences and had been on the road. One had been out for 26 years. One had been out for 41 years. Then I went down to Downey, California, and talked to a deputy DA named Robert Samoyan, who was very helpful in helping me go through some of the legal ramifications. Now, the law is unpredictable at best, and it does change from season to season, so that certainly there may be other possibilities in terms of what would actually happen to him. But I kept laying out, I kept saying, this is what I want to do. Now you tell me how to make this work. And he was very helpful to me. As far as I know, my facts are correct, and I try to be real meticulous about the legal aspects. I would love it if I had a law degree, but I don't want to stop and do that.
Kinsey Milhone has a real life of her own, I think, which is one of the things that makes her more interesting than a good many fictional detectives.
Thanks.
Her peculiar quasi-romance with her 82-year-old landlord.
Oh, is he darling?
he's a real sweetie pie. I hope you're not going to kill him off.
No, but, you know, he is 82, and we got 20 years to go here with these books, so I can't. I'm hoping to keep him in good health, but life is not predictable either.
And Kinsey herself is a strange mixture of a bit of a health nut. She certainly does a lot of exercise. But she drinks a good deal, and I believe she smokes cigarettes.
Oh, never.
She doesn't.
Eek. Yeah.
I'm thinking of someone else.
No, she's not a smoker. And she generally drinks cheap wine. I'm trying to upgrade her taste a tiny bit. But readers are funny. They write you letters if your character drinks too much, so you have to watch that a little bit. And usually her interest in physical fitness is to defy the laws of gravity. She is not passionate about exercise. I think she does it, like many of us, to just offset the aging process mm-hmm. where possible. She is not a fitness fiend.
Would you say she looks like you?
I don't know. I hope she's better looking. I think her hair is shorter because she talks about cutting it every 6 weeks with a pair of nail scissors, whether she needs it or not. And you know she doesn't wear makeup, which I personally admire. You know, I think that's terrific. She is not a vain creature by any stretch of the imagination. She's thinner than I am, and she eats worse, I tell you.
Is she ever going to get remarried?
Nope, and she'll never have children. She'll probably never have a pet either. I gave her in E is for Evidence, I gave her an air fern. An air fern requires no care whatsoever, and it already made her nervous, you know, to have that much responsibility.
But she does hang out a good deal in sleazy saloons.
That's right.
Why do so many detectives hang out so much in sleazy saloons?
Well, I think that's where perhaps the truth is. I don't know. She actually hangs out a fair amount with the rich, too, which I think are just as amazing to her as the sleaze bags in the world. I think the rich are interesting.
Did you have any kind of relation similar to the aunt who raised Kinsey Milhone?
No, and in fact, I had parents who lived... They're both dead now, but I was thinking about that today. There's a sort of symbolic logic to having the parents nuked, really. Partly because I really don't want to deal with family situations. I don't want Kinsey going home for Thanksgiving. I like her quite isolated in the world. It serves my purposes. And it's one reason, frankly, why I don't get her involved in romance very often, because I don't want to write a mystery novel full of witty repartee with lovers, you know, whipping up little gourmet treats for each other. So,
a la Spencer.
Yeah. It's easier just to keep her single and happy about it.
And getting involved with cops who were married.
Yeah. See, Jonas, I have to watch his step because he's not doing right by her, and I don't think he's going to last too much longer. But
there's a kind of melancholy quality to a lot of these books and to Kinsey's own reaction to the people she meets and the events that overtake them. Is that deliberate?
I think it is because I would like to believe the mystery novel can be a vehicle for observing how the world works, and not just the world, but the dark side of the world. So it is possible that her view is a bit jaundiced. I don't think she sees us at our best.
Well, dealing with crime and criminals all the time,
that's
I guess
right.
Not.
Yeah, not nice stuff.
She also seems very aware of the aging process.
Yeah, ain't we all? She doesn't know how lucky she is.
You mentioned G is for Gumshoe. Now, we're just talking about a brand new book as of spring 1989, which is F is for Fugitive.
Yes.
What's the status of G?
Well, I'm halfway through G. I start a book every November, and I deliver a manuscript every August 15. So if I do a book tour such as this one, it'll come right smack in the middle of whatever book I'm working on, nervous-making stuff. In this case, I brought my laptop along with me, so it's toting, trailing cords from city to city, and I'm hoping I can stay in touch with the book. And my horror always is that I'll get home at the end of a tour and think what I'm writing is junk and have to start all over again. I am not a rapid writer, and it's hard to be away from the book.
Well, has the advent of the home computer and the laptop beyond that impacted your work methods?
Oh, yeah. I love my word processor because it keeps the prose very liquid. I revise incessantly. You can take a sentence and try it five different ways and see which one really suits you. At the end of a piece of writing, you can push a button and it all comes out beautifully printed with no boo-boos in it. I love it. I am a far better writer because of a word processor.
I'd like to ask a little bit about how you create a mystery. I mean, as someone who occasionally tries to sit down and develop plots for myself of other things, do you know, for example, who the villain is going to be, or are you surprised? Do you construct the entire thing outline by outline, or do you just wing it?
I do a combination. I know who done what to whom. I know why. I know what it's supposed to look like. I try desperately to fool the reader as honorably as possible. I live in horror that it's totally transparent from page two. I outline where I need to, but I find that beginnings are easy and endings are easy, and it's the middle that torments a writer. And that's the place where I try to let the book guide me to some extent. I think one needs to work in some sort of framework with a mystery because I think winging it is very hazardous stuff. At the same time, if I knew everything that was going to happen, I'd be too bored to begin.
In the case of F is for Fugitive, you knew who the villain was
yes.
from the beginning.
Yes. And I know in G also, sometimes what gets altered is the backstory. It's like, and that really gets tricky. If I've laid out a certain portion of the book and then I decide that the motivation is off, I have to go back and reconstruct it so it will fit what I've already done because I'm way too lazy to trash it and start again. But I think many mystery writers are fairly good at structuring. For smart, that's what we do.
The process you describe is almost identical to the method described by John D. MacDonald, the late John D. MacDonald, who was one of our very first guests here years and
is
years
that
ago.
Right? Yeah.
He said, I always know the start of the story and I always know the end of the story, but I don't know what goes in between, and I only find out when I write it.
Yeah, well, Jonathan Gash just a few weeks ago said he starts writing and he never knows where it's going to go.
Oh, I don't have that much nerve.
That would be very scary, I would think.
Well, some of what I do, I learned from Tony Hillerman, who says the process is like driving in fog, in that you can see a certain distance ahead of you, so you drive to that point, and then the road clears a certain distance beyond that. So it was fun to read about that.
Since you mentioned Hillerman, there are an awful lot of mystery writers out there today, including some very, very good ones. Do you have a particular set of favorites?
I love Dutch Leonard, Elmore Leonard, Tony Hillerman, Dick Francis, Ruth Rendell. Outside of the mystery field, I read who everybody else reads, Ann Tyler, Tom Wolfe. Ruth Rendell is probably my favorite because I think she is such a master constructionist. I think her stories are complex, and I think her characterization is incredible. She just has a real mastery of what she's doing.
There were a number of women writers writing about private eyes, Marcia Muller, Mickey Friedman, Julie Smith, Shelley Singer. Do you see your works fitting in with them, or do you see the distinction between a woman writing about a woman and a hard-boiled detective?
Oh, that's a tough question, because I know those women. We all hang out together,
right.
And it's hard. Sometimes I think a writer is the least qualified person to make judgments about how we fit into anything. You know, I work real hard to stay in my own soul and stay in my own gut and not get into analytical matters, so I don't know if I can give you a fair answer to that. I mean, I could give you perhaps a far-flung one, but I don't think it would be truthful. It seems to me that the hard-boiled female private eye is a new direction that women writers are beginning to be attracted to. I don't see it's better, different. It is unlike other things, and I admire Julie's work. I admire Shelley Singer. I just try not to get into very many judgments about other writers because I know each of us is struggling with the same set of problems in some form. I just solve mine differently.
It seems to me that there's a certain natural convergence here that has to happen. You have a background in TV and film writing, including doing mysteries, and you've written these six mystery novels and a number of short stories about Kinsey Millhone.
Yes.
Why isn't there a Kinsey Millhone TV series? I would turn it on tonight.
But it would turn out like all the other TV mystery shows. It would be drug cartels and gun battles, and I don't think that's what I'm about. For one thing, Steve Humphrey and I have worked in television far too long to do it to ourselves. We're too smart to sell it to television. I don't care about the money. The money doesn't interest me. If it means selling out Kinsey Millhone, because I have 20 years to go on this, and I can't afford to have television do what they would do to her. Film might be a different matter if the right deal ever came along, and that would have to do more with casting than with cash.
You have had feelers then. That's pretty obvious.
Yes. Usually the casting suggestions for television are so absurd, if you know who Kinsey Millhone is, that it's just not worth discussing. Suzanne Fleshette is suggested. And Sally Struthers and Loretta Swett. And I think to myself, have you read these books? Do you know who I am or what is going on here? So, it's better to just not get into that, because once you work in television, you know that you have no control whatsoever over what's done. And I prefer not to trivialize this woman. I feel clever enough to have invented somebody who now supports me, and I don't think it would be smart to take her down those alleyways.
If there were movies, who would you prefer?
I always pictured Sigourney Weaver or Deborah Winger. Whether those actresses would have any interest, I a little doubt, as they say where I come from. But somewhere there is an actress who is going to end up being Kinsey Millhone, and she might be in junior high school now putting on acne medication and with braces on her teeth, but we'll get there eventually.
We've been talking with Sue Grafton, author of the Kinsey Millhone Mysteries. A is for alibi, B is for burglar, C is for corpse, D is for deadbeat, E is for evidence, the new one, F is for fugitive, and coming, G is for gumshoe, and A
on acne medication and with braces on her teeth, but we'll get there eventually.
We've been talking with Sue Grafton, author of the Kinsey Millhone Mysteries. A is for alibi, B is for burglar, C is for corpse, D is for deadbeat, E is for evidence, the new one, F is for fugitive, and coming, G is for gumshoe, and H is not for homicide.
Oh, it's for something. I hope you'll help me with that.
I'm Richard Walensky with Richard A. Lupoff. Good night.